of a 5 decibel noise figure. 5 decibel noise figure, 20 decibels of gain, means it is a 5 plus 20, it is a 25 dB TXS noise generator. It is generating noise 25 dB louder than a 50 ohm resistor would be at room temperature. It's got 20 dB of gain, 5 dB of noise figure, it amplifies its own noise, so it's a continuous noise generator. During the time you want it to be receiving, that amplifier is cranking out noise, unless you've got an extremely large amount of isolation in that transmit-receive relay that tries to send the transmitting signal from your signal generator into the antenna when you're transmitting, and then flips over and does a receiving in the other direction and doesn't allow any of the noise through. As you can tell, there's a lot of exotic requirements for that particular transmit-receive relay. The smartest thing to do, and I've done this, is to use two separate transmitting and receiving antennas, two separate antennas. Two Yagi side by side, two feed horns side by side, however you do it. The transmitter, your signal generator is set to antenna number one. Your receiving antenna at the same site, and the receiving antenna is only a few feet away, but two well-designed Yagi side by side can easily have 30 dB of isolation between the two, maybe even 40 dB. So therefore, you don't have to be flipping a relay, and you've got tremendous isolation from the excess noise of the transmitter. If you've got 35 dB of isolation between the two antennas, and your transmitter has got 25 dB of TXS, essentially you'll never see that noise from the transmitter. The system will now be beautifully sensitive. Let me drop you and show you what else.
Repeater, timeout.
The next thing to worry about is now some of the radars that I have set up. One of the radars I set up was transmitting 200 milliwatts, 2/10 of a watt. I'm not kidding. At 10 gigahertz with a 3-foot diameter dish, I made a solid-state homebrew radar transmitting 2/10 of a watt, and I was looking at the echo of a target 5 miles away, line of sight. I saw some beautiful echoes. That happened to be a very large echoing device. It happened to be an ASR-8 radar, the great big 100-foot wide, I think it is. I think it's 100 foot wide, or is it 80 foot wide? I'm not sure of the exact width of the antenna. 150 square feet. So it's 15 feet wide, 10 foot high, is the actual radar antenna on an ASR-8. The FAA radars you've got at many of your airports. All right, I was 5 miles away at a hotel, 10th floor balcony of a hotel, aiming this antenna at the radar. And you can read this whole story by going to amateurradio.tv. You go to the articles by K2RIW, and you look at the article on, I think it was the article on radar cross-section. I forget what I think it was the antenna scattering area. If you look at the article, antenna scattering area, which is broken up into three separate chapters, and you look at the third chapter, you'll see the details of this particular radar experiment that I did. Let me drop the mic. So from 5 miles away, if the target is big enough, I got a beautiful echo with a 2/10 of a watt radar. That was the peak envelope power of the radar, 2/10 of a watt. Okay, and I've also worked on a radar that has, I think it's like 30 million watts of peak power going into a 137-foot wide antenna. I'm talking about the FPS-35 radar that's out at Montauk Point. Okay, I did a little bit of work on that particular radar. And the reason why Sperry won the contract to build that radar is because they had decided to build a 137-foot wide antenna to make sure they had lots of range out of it, and that was the quite a few of those radars were set up around the United States in order to protect the air defense identification zone. It was an over-the-horizon 400 megacycle radar, and when that radar was operational, did that give us noise on 432 meg handband? Wow, you wouldn't believe. There were times when, even though that radar was 70 miles away from me out there on Montauk Point, to me here in Huntington, that gave me a signal 100 dB over my noise. Really potent signals. Let me drop them. But in the case of this radar experiment he would like to build, I strongly recommend he put two antennas side by side. And now, let me show you some of the things that determine range. In the case of a handy talkie at 5 or 6 watts, depending on what antenna, what frequency range, and how you set up the environment, your range can be anything from 3 miles to 12 billion miles. In the case of a radar you're setting up like this, you know the exact frequency you're transmitting. Therefore, you know the exact frequency. got the pulse timing network on the transmitter tied to the receiver, and you're running an oscilloscope on the receiver, and therefore that same pulse network is timing the sweep of the oscilloscope that's doing the receiving. You know when to do the receiving. You know the frequency. And if the target is not moving, you even know the phase angle of the signal coming back, because you're using a frequency synthesizer on the signal generator, and therefore you have the capability of doing coherent demodulation. If you pull out all the stops, on top of that, you have another ability. You could be transmitting, let me pick a number, 1,000 pulses per second, and you don't have to have perfect sensitivity of detecting each individual pulse. There's all kinds of ways you can use post-detection integration techniques. You can literally lay 1,000 pulses on top of each other and integrate them. And because the pulses are coherent, they're coming from a frequency synthesized signal generator, and you put 1,000 pulses on top of each other electronically in the receiver pulse detection processing network, you now get the signals all adding together in phase. The noise that's present in your receiver adds out of phase. Therefore, the improvement happens to be square root of the number of pulses. If you're integrating 1,000 pulses, you take the square root of that. I think the answer is roughly 31. The signal-to-noise ratio will improve by...
Repeater, timeout.
If you decide to integrate 1,000 pulses in your receiving technique, you'll get a 31 improvement in signal-to-noise ratio because you're integrating 1,000 pulses. So there's all kinds of art and science you can add to this radar system. I strongly recommend you use two separate antennas side by side. That's the way I did it. And by the way, your typical radar, like the particular radar that was present at AIL, which I think was an FPS-20, it had on a good day a range of around 200 miles. You could see aircraft targets 200 miles away, and you could detect the range of those targets probably within the nearest mile or so. So you had a mile of accuracy in range and a 200-mile distance around that particular radar on a good day when the weather was right. Okay, I built a radar which had a range resolution of not a mile, had a range resolution of 1/4 of 1 foot. And I'm not kidding. That radar was putting out 1,000,000 pulses per second. Each pulse was 1/4 of a nanosecond long at 10 gigahertz. Each individual pulse was 3 hertz, three cycles of a 10 gigahertz signal. And that radar was putting out something like 1,000 watts. But because 1/4 of a nanosecond and 1,000,000 pulses per second, I think it turned out to be a fraction of a watt was the average power. You look at the duty factor of that mathematics. As such, I had human beings walking around in that chamber while this thing was running, because the average power was only a fraction of a watt. But I was using this to measure the echoes, the undesired echoes, in this great big chamber out at Edwards Air Force Base. And we wanted to find out in which piece of foam on the floor, there's an acre and a half of foam on the floor of these pyramids, which ones had nails and adapters and things like that, wrenches that had been dropped into it. Let me drop. Question. By putting out pulses that brief, and 1,000,000 pulses per second, and with the right kind of a detection technique, I could get range resolution of 1/4 of a foot. And the antenna itself that did the transmitting in that particular case happened to be the high-gain antenna on the B-1 airplane, which was sitting on the turntable in the middle of that chamber. And by allowing the turntable to rotate, the couple of degrees of beam width out of the transmitting antenna was like a flashlight. I was literally radio-wise shining a flashlight in that room. And as we rotated the airplane, and we had 1/4 of a foot of range resolution, and I'm looking at those echoes, I could find every reflecting device in that chamber, as I said, with a resolution of 1/4 of a foot. What's your question on this one, Wes? N2XJN, K2LAW.
Yeah, actually, when you were doing your explanation, you were mentioning the properties of electromagnetic waves. The question for you is, why are electromagnetic waves not affected by an external field, while they are composed of mutually perpendicular magnetic and electric fields? N2XJN.
There's about five different questions I could use, I could find out of the words you've used. Okay. All radio signals propagating in free space pass through each other with absolutely no interaction. That's one way of looking at it. Thought of what I think you're asking. Look, the wave going out and the wave coming back, they pass through each other with no effect of any kind. Very similar to what happens on a transmission line that has a standing wave ratio, because the load at the far end is not the proper resistive load. You've got some signal going forward from your transmitter, you have some signal reflected from your antenna that's less than perfect, and the signal reflected from the antenna comes back down toward the transmitter, and those two signals do not interact with each other. They pass through each other. And you can see a similar effect like that. If you drop a pebble into the north side of a puddle, and you see some waves travel to the south. You drop a pebble into the south side of a puddle, you see some wave travel into the north. You drop a pebble into the north and the south side of a puddle simultaneously, you'll see those waves pass through each other with no interaction, as long as the waves are short and are small enough that you're not getting a nonlinear effect, no white cap, so to speak. So in almost all transmitting medium, a signal flowing from north to south does not see a signal flowing from south to north, even if the frequency is identical, even if it's the same signal generator that made both signals. And if you now go the next step and make the signals on a different frequency with maybe different polarization, there's three different reasons as to why they don't interact. Just a linear medium propagating a radio signal behaves in that manner, whether it's a piece of waveguide, whether it's a piece of coax cable, or whether it's free space and air. Radio waves do that. But now getting back to what I'm saying about this radar that you're building homebrew as an experimenter. Let me drop. Some of the magic of radio that makes us so excited is that it gives us action at a distance. I sit here and I press a Morse code key, or I speak into a microphone, and the guy 10 miles away or 10,000 miles away hears what I'm saying and answers me. That's action at a distance. In the case of radar, you don't even have to wait for the guy to react. In most cases, when you set up a radar system, you see the answer immediately on the screen, and you're seeing it in real time. When there's a moving target out there in the dark, and you set up a homebrew ham radio radar system, and you watch that target move in real time, it's a target that you've made move, or it's your dog, and you've called your dog, and you watch him come toward you, when you see it in real time on a radar screen, it's exciting material. At least it is to me. And so, now, by the way you set up the receiver, there's a zillion ways you can make an extremely sensitive radar receiver. Because you know the exact frequency you're transmitting, you know the exact pulse repetition rate, you know the exact pulse rate, you know the exact phase angle of what your signal you're sending, and if that target is sitting still, there's all kinds of ways you can have a very sensitive receiver with all kinds of post-detection, either coherent and non-coherent, and simultaneous coherent and non-coherent integration to improve the signal-to-noise ratio. Therefore, there are situations where a literally flea power transmitter, let me drop, almost a flea power transmitter can give you awful good sensitivity for looking at targets. And so now, as in his particular case, 100 foot away, a receiving antenna, another Yagi, goes from 7 foot of cable into a termination. And it could be a perfect 50-ohm termination, which absorbs all the signal. And if you make the termination a short circuit or an open circuit, so that all the signal received by the antenna now gets re-reflected back from the termination through the 7 feet of cable into that antenna, will that signal become retransmitted? Absolutely. Every single bit of it will be retransmitted. Your next question is, how much stronger will the echo on this well-designed homebrew radar system, how strong will the echo be when you go from a perfect termination to a short circuit? That's the implied question. The answer is going to surprise you a little bit. Let me drop. Whenever you launch a radio signal into free air, that radio signal wants to see nothing but 377 ohm impedance, free air, or vacuum. You put anything into that air. I don't care if it's a stealthy aircraft, I don't care if it's a bird, a piece of 2x4, an I-beam, or a piece of sheet metal. No matter what you put in that air, you're going to get an echo. The signal that hits that object is going to be scattered. Some of that signal is going to be re-reflected. Reflection, deflection, refraction. All of that's going to take place. You can't stop it from happening. Anytime you transmit a signal anywhere, you're getting multipath. You're lighting up the whole environment. It's all kinds of, whenever you turn on a transmitter, turn an antenna, you're lighting up the whole environment. Everything in that environment is getting some amount of that radio signal. You can't stop that from happening. So if you've been doing a radar experiment all of your life, whenever you do a transmitter, you just happen not to have set up a receiver to look at the echo that you just created. Can we drop?
You drifted a little bit off the question.
I'm back to the lecture. I'm not answering questions right now, Wes. So that the multipath phenomena that we all see is going to give you echoes off of everything in the environment. So you're always doing a radar experiment. You just happen to not set up the proper kind of receiver to see it. With the proper kind of receiver, you're going to see it. You put an antenna. I don't care what kind of an antenna it is. You put an antenna out there in front of your transmitting system. You're going to get an echo off of it. Every single antenna has something that a radar person is going to call radar cross-sectional area. A certain amount of echo. That antenna, no matter how it is set up, no matter what kind of impedance matching you've done, what kind of viswire you've corrected, no matter what kind of termination you put on its transmission line, it is an object that's different than the 377 ohms. You're going to get a hell of a big echo off of it. This is a very painful lesson that's been taught to an awful lot of people that set up a stealthy airplane. You can spend a small fortune making your F-117 airplane or your B-2 airplane or your B-1 airplane as low in echo power as possible. Let me drop. Then you put forth this heroic effort to make the echo of your airplane very low. Now mount an antenna on the airplane because you want to communicate with somebody. Echo that the antenna creates can easily be, in some cases, 10 times louder than the whole darn airplane, even though the antenna is only 1% of the area of the airplane. Antennas do that. Every antenna's got an echo. So that Yagi out there, if your radar receiver is set up correctly, you're going to see an echo from the antenna, even when the antenna is perfectly terminated. Now you change the termination of the antenna so that all the signal it receives is now re-reflected, retransmitted, you could say. A rough guess is the echo you're going to get off that antenna is going to go up by about 6 dB. It's not going to be no echo of the antenna because it's properly terminated. That antenna is going to give you, if the radar is working correctly, you're going to get one hell of an echo off the antenna when it's perfectly terminated. And now you make it a short circuit, the echo is going to get somewhat louder. 6 dB is a good guess. I know this is different than common sense. I know it's different than what you expect. Been there, done that. I've seen this in real life. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thanks, Ian. I've finished.
KWGB. Okay, Dick, good information. So from what you're saying, radar cross-section will get a little larger if it is a resonant antenna. Any antenna is going to show a radar cross-section, but if the antenna itself is resonant and it is reflecting signal beside, that will be a larger cross-section from what I understand you're saying.
That's a good way of putting it. But even if it was a non-resonant antenna, if it was a rhombic antenna, which is a traveling wave antenna that does not resonate, if it was a rhombic antenna, you would still get a somewhat similar answer, John, believe it or not. You're going to get an echo from the rhombic antenna when it's properly terminated, and now you make it a short circuit termination. The echo will get louder because the signal that it normally absorbs is now going to be retransmitted. Over to you, John, K2RIW. Resonance will increase the area of the antenna, the radar cross-sectional area, but even a non-resonant antenna, it's still an object disturbing free space. You're going to get an echo off of it. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
KCTV. Very good, Dick. Good explanation. Got a lot of information there. Also, if you think you have time, you may want to explain that corner reflector and the type of shadow it makes, like you were explaining it to me. I don't think very many people are aware of how much radar cross-section that could cause if you were to put one of those small things on an aircraft. I mean, doesn't seem, it doesn't follow the basic logic very well. But if you feel like you want to get that information, maybe you want to try that too. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, good point on this one, John. When you're testing your radar, and you want to do a standard test to measure its sensitivity, there's at least two ways you can do it. One way is to take a spherical object that's conductive, call it a balloon covered with a tinfoil, if you like, but you've got a thoroughly conducting spherical device. The way a radar works is that if that spherical device has a shadow area of 1 square meter, you've made the balloon big enough, it's a conducting balloon, it's a metal sphere, and at high noon it casts a shadow on the ground of 1 square meter. By definition, by the radar definition, that is a 1 square meter effective target. Therefore, because it's got that shadow area of 1 square meter, it's going to absorb that amount of radar signal, 1 square meter's worth of it. If the radar signal, by the time it gets to your target, is down to 1 watt per square meter, so to speak, you've got a cross-sectional area of 1 square meter, you're going to absorb 1 watt. The theory is that once you've lit up this spherical object with that radar signal, it re-radiates in all directions equally. It's an isotropic radiator. That is the assumption. In reality, it makes a slightly stronger signal in the retro direction. The echo direction is a little bit stronger than the other direction, but it does re-radiate in all directions. And so that would be called a 1 square meter effective target. You can put that 1 square meter effective area metal sphere on another airplane, drop it with a parachute, and while it's dropping toward the water, so to speak, you aim your radar on the land at this thing, look at the amount of echoes you get, know the number of miles to that thing, and with a little bit of mathematics, you now know the sensitivity of your radar. You can find out that, yeah, my radar is dropping. You can now find out that the radar is putting out the right amount of power, the antenna has the right aiming, it's got the right elevation, the receiver is working correctly. By the amount of echo you see on the client position indicator of that radar screen, you can say, yes, my radar today is working correctly because I've used that sphere. But John's original question is the corner reflector. If you take a look at the three sheets of the room that you're in right now, look at the two walls that meet at right angles and look at where it meets the ceiling. In that corner where all three sheets come together, if you cut out a piece of that, you will now have three flat sheets of material all at right angles to each other. That's a tri-corner reflector, and you can now picture it being held above the ground at high noon, and you know it's going to create a certain amount of area. And now, what's the amount of echo you get off of that? Let me first go back to an ordinary antenna. I'd like to finish my talk first because I've allocated a piece of time in order to give this talk. I'm following your advice. Every antenna has an amount of area that equals 4 pi a over lambda. That the gain is 4 pi a over lambda squared. Every antenna follows that rule. Gain equals 4 pi area effective over lambda squared. And so you can resolve that formula for area. Area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. Every antenna has an amount of effective area, which is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. And not too complicated for me to plug in the numbers. In the case of that tri-sheet corner reflector, the effective area of that is not gain lambda squared over 4 pi. It is area squared over 4 pi. Area squared lambda over 4 pi. It's equivalent to a flat sheet of metal that's exactly normal to the radar signal. The way the signal goes into that corner reflector, the signal is going to bounce off of all three sides. And when it comes back, it always comes back in the exact direction it came in. That's the magic of that three-sided corner reflector. No matter what angle the signal comes in, it comes right back out at the exact same angle with full surface area, so to speak. Let me drop. Therefore, you know the area of that thing, and it gives you a great, it's the biggest area you're going to get. 1 square foot of cross-sectional area of a three-sided chunk of metal like that can give you an echo that's 1,000 times louder than the sphere, because the sphere radiates the signal in all directions at once. That three-cornered thing re-rates the signal only in the direction it came from. It can easily be, under certain circumstances, 1,000 times louder. You put one of those on the back end of an airplane, boy, do you get an echo. I mean, that thing might have 1 square foot of effective area, shadow area, so to speak, and it could easily give you an echo that's 10 or 20 dB louder than the whole damn airplane it's mounted on. I know, because one of the radars that was being tested by AIL, they had trouble making it sensitive enough at the range they wanted to make it at, so they hung one of those corner reflector devices on the back end of the airplane, and boy, did it show up. I think this is some of the answer you were looking for, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Dick, that's perfect, and that covers that question pretty well. I also emailed him if he had any further questions or wanted to know any of the styles of measurement that he could send that in, and I would discuss that with you maybe next week. So, okay, I think Wesley had a question, but back to you, Dick. KC2WGB, thank you for the effort.
This is DPZ as a comment, Dick.
Yeah, I'm going to pick up Hal in a minute. It turns out that when you start doing experiments with radar-like principles, at first you think it's complicated and it's hard. It's not. There are ways, step-by-step, you can do it homebrew and make it easy, but if you've got an oscilloscope that can do the display, if you've got a receiver that can do the receiving, and if you're willing to set up two antennas side-by-side, you'd be amazed what kind of radar experiments you could run. And when you set up these two antennas side-by-side, maybe they're mounted to one common mast, and if you're doing it on a high enough frequency, like a 900 megacycles or 1296, you could make this so-called sniffing device. In other words, you could make this all transistorized, portable, battery-operated. You could walk around the environment and aim it at things and look at the display, look at the echo of the things in your backyard, your radio tower, the house, the telephone pole out front, the car. The car's going by in front of the house. You'd be amazed the kind of fun you can have with that. One of the things that I was able to do at 10 gigahertz is listening to the echo of raindrops. And the raindrops echoes because they're moving. They gave me a Doppler shift. They give you a whistling sound. And when you hear the whistle of raindrops dropping in front of your antenna, very exciting sound, fun stuff. Let's see, I bet you've done some radar experiments in your day, Hal. K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Yes, I did get that, and now I'll repeat it. What Hal is mentioning is the fact that there is something called an echo box. It really is a kind of a cavity resonator. If you've ever looked at the old fashioned Hewlett-Packard frequency meter, it really was a vertical tubular device with a spiral scale on it, and you turned the great big knob on the top, and you tuned it to a particular frequency. And now when you have a sweeper set up, you would get a glitch on the oscilloscope screen at a particular frequency, and therefore what's happening is that as your sweeper signal generator swept across that resonator coil, that resonator cavity thing, the signal would be sucked out at that one particular frequency on this there's a straight-to-coax cable, a little bit like what you've got with a Bird Model 43. Let me drop. And there's a small hole in the side or a sampling probe that goes into that cavity so that when you hit the signal of resonance of the cavity with your sweeper signal generator, the amount of insertion loss changes. You get a glitch in the display. You get a notch in the display, and therefore you can measure frequency quite accurately with those frequency meters. All right, if you use one of those frequency meter-like devices on a radar, each radar pulse puts some energy into that cavity. The energy resonates for a certain period of time, therefore you get an echo on the radar screen for a certain period of time. It's a ringing signal that decays in time, but for the amount of time it delays, knowing the cue of the cavity, you know how long the ring time should be and how long the ring time should be displayed on your screen if the radar is putting out the right amount of power and if the receiver has the right amount of sensitivity. So by coupling this echo box into the waveguide of your radar system, you're now able to, in a thoroughly passive manner, measure most of the sensitivity of the radar, not counting the antenna. And in most cases, the antenna is a piece of geometry. You look at the antenna, as long as somebody hasn't put a great big dent in it, and the feed horn is hanging in the right spot, you can make a guess that the radar antenna is probably in good shape. And by using this echo box in the feed line, you can now confirm all the rest of the hardware of the radar. Is that approximately what you had in mind, Hal? K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet. I'll be able to hear you on the input. As you guys can see, the word radar, my goodness, does it have a zillion different meanings from the time it was first invented. Oh, depending on who you talk to, real radar development took place during World War II, and that was the chunk of electronics that made a huge difference in that war. And if you get a hold of Skolnick's book called Introduction to Radar, a real classic book, and there's at least two editions of that, Skolnick's Introduction to Radar, and then Skolnick has got a great big book, the Red Book I call it, which probably got about 30 or more chapters, called The Radar Handbook. I mean, two of the world's best books that I know of is the Antenna Engineering Handbook, and there's four editions of that, and Skolnick's Radar Handbook. It is a Bible on the subject. And so you look at the chapters in there where you can evaluate the radar cross-section of various targets, how you make various kinds of radars. There's zillions of kinds of radar. It's a very ubiquitous word, radio detection and ranging. But as a ham radio experimenting device, it doesn't take a whole lot of expensive hardware if you're crafty enough, and you can have an awful lot of fun with that one. Back to you, John, for any comments on this one. And so I think your writer has just begun a subject where, as he gets into it, he's going to have more and more fun with it. A couple of things will not work quite the way you want to at first. But once he comes back and tells us what he tried, what glitch he got, I'm pretty sure we can tell him what to do next. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Good stuff, Dick. Yeah, I think if he understands to use three antennas, one for transmitting, his target receiving antenna, and his receiver antenna co-located with the transmitting antenna, I think he'll save himself a lot of time and have a little more fun and be able to actually accomplish that. It sounds like a very similar to what I was trying to do here last week or 2 weeks ago with my little detection of reflection off of a house, which I'm working on. So, all right, Dick, back to you. I think Wesley had a question. I'm not sure. If not, we'll go over to Paul.
JAS.
I heard JAS. We'll get to you in a second. One other thing I should mention. Now, when it comes to processing the radar pulses in the receiver, post-detection integration techniques, when it comes to adding a computer to that, where you're using coherent and incoherent integration techniques, and these super-sensitivity techniques that Joe Taylor has invented, weak signal Joe Taylor, WSJT techniques, there are ways of applying that to a radar receiver where you've got enough knowledge of the frequency, pulse duration, pulse rep rate, and phase angle of the transmitted signals. You add all the modern-day computer processing techniques to a radar system. A very simple low-power radar system can give you all kinds of extra sensitivity. So as long as you haven't thrown it away by way of the isolation of the transmit-receive relay up front, the timing of the transmit-receive relay, and the noise output in the steady state of your own transmitter. Your own transmitter, if you're not careful, is putting out a lot of noise when you think you're doing receiving. Therefore, a separate antenna makes that a whole lot better. J
KAS?
Go ahead with your question. K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, another question though about something called ADS-B. Can you relate that to radar?
Okay, I think I heard you say Alpha, Delta, Sierra, Bravo. Is that what you said?
Affirmative.
I may have heard it in other terms. Tell me where you heard it. Give me a context. Is it with reference to processing techniques on the receiver, the transmitter, coherence, antenna techniques? Give me a couple of hints if you happen to have that. Roger, go ahead.
1YD1, no, have you
heard that? I did it in my airplane, and it's with the aircraft.
Okay, you dropped out an awful lot. W1YDY, he said he's got an answer for that. Go ahead, YDY.
Ow. Antenna problem, I'll get back.
And listening question.
Okay, while we're waiting for YDY to come back, Wes, go ahead.
Yeah, I was asking, at first I got into the point of manipulating light with the magnetic field, which practically is impossible. But then we have a component of electromagnetic waves, and that would be magnetic field, and that would be electric field. You say that the Maxwell equation predicts that electric and magnetic fields can propagate through the space at speeds of light. So we have a few space sense right now. Now, once the electromagnetic radiation is made from perpendicular electric and magnetic fields, when it is in form of photon, it is immune to magnetic field. So my question is, why? And thanks here.
An overly simplistic answer is that the Maxwell's equations tell you that you only have a transmitted electromagnetic wave and photon. The magnetic field is changing at a particular rate, and the electric field is changing at a particular rate. A steady state magnetic field is not changing, therefore it doesn't get transmitted by the same technique. I know that's probably not the answer you're looking for, but that might be what's really going on. Back to you, Wes.
K-E-2-E-J.
I believe it's oversimplified, but the thing is that when we're dealing with electromagnetic waves, we're dealing with light as well. So now the question was, will light be immune to magnetic field, or will not? It means, will photons be immune to electrodynamics applied to the photon?
Eric has information on the previous subject when you get a chance to.
No. The components of that conversion are no longer to apply. Enter here.
Eric said he's got an answer to this. KE2EJ, KE2LAW. Go ahead, Eric. And electromagnetic theory is so simple. So simplify it for us, Eric. I'm pulling his leg. You cut it, Eric.
K2LAW, KE2EJ. Okay, ADS-B is part of the actual next-gen system. It stands for Automatic Dependent Surveillance Broadcast. It transmits on 1090 megahertz. And basically what it's doing is repeating the GPS location of an airline, of an aircraft. And that's part of the next-gen system, which is actually active now, and it is the active replacement for radar, and it also allows air traffic to move in places that they never have before, where you don't need VOR, you don't need the radar, plus the fact that the United States has does not have 100% radar coverage as the rest of the world. K2RIW, K2 John.
Great answer, thank you.
Yeah, maybe Bill N1YDY wanted to add to that much. So, in the past, he did a lot of identifying my aircraft by a so-called IFF system that also worked at 1090 megahertz. What's the difference between IFF, the classic thing that supposedly was invented by Hazeltine way back in the Dark Ages, what's the difference between IFF and ATSB? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2J. IFF actually becomes a radar target that actually is, you know, it's your typical transponder. The ADS-B operates on the same frequency, so it shows up on the radar with its information, but it also has, as part of its data stream, its lat and long coordinates, along with the regular beacon information. So it's, in essence, is in addition to, as opposed to, different. K2RIW.
OSR recognized, but let me go back to Eric for a second. So what I think you're saying is that if I take an IFF-like system, I now, on the transponder pulse that it sends back to the interrogating radar, if I now give latitude and long information, and maybe altitude information, if I'm a FAA controller, I'd really like to know the latitude, long, and altitude of that target. How much of that information does ADS-B transmit? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Yes, it gives you altitude, it gives you the flight number, it gives you the registration number of the aircraft, and there's some more stuff that, that's in there. I can look it up, but, and you guys can look it up too, but there's a whole bunch of things. Let me see. It gives you, it also has a set of packets for weather. It also, as far as the way it's interpreted at the air traffic control station, it gives you spacing between your nearest aircraft. There's a lot of stuff in it, so I'm only barely scratching the surface. K2RIW, KETJ.
I'm pretty sure I heard Bob in the OSR. I'm going to get to him in a second. Under normal circumstances, an IFF response is only a few microseconds total duration. If I'm now transmitting a data stream, which is all the bits of latitude, all the bits of longitude, all the bits of altitude, all the bits of aircraft location, aircraft identification, where in the world does all the time come from for transmitting all that data in the usual format of an IFF response? Where's all that extra time coming from, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
1YDY.
K2RIW, K2EJ. This is now what, at the moment, it's a shared system. It supplements CISD, which is the traffic information service, supplements the ADS-B air-to-air services, sound radars, let's see, couplings that drive from ground surveillance sources, like ground radar and secondary targets. I can't give you what you're really asking for, but I know it is sent as a burst. As far as, like, how big the burst is, we're talking milliseconds, if that long. But you can do it at very high baud rates, so the amount of time that you're going to eat up is relatively small. And currently on my computer, I have an SDR dongle with a decoding program for ADS-B. It's interesting to watch the planes go by. K2RIW, K2J, pick up YDY. You probably have some good information.
Is that transmitted like ACARS?
Let's pick up Bill. N1YDY, clear us up on this one, Bill. It sounds like you've used these systems. You got a Bill. N1YDY, K2RIW.
Okay, first, not to be a pain, but the name is Hank, not Bill. But theoretically, you guys are missing the whole, not theoretically, but in practical, you guys are missing the whole point. What's really happening here is that radar is a ground-based system where you know where the radar transmitter site is, and you determine the aircraft location by referencing it to the fixed location of the radar. And what fundamentally is different with the ADIS-B is now each aircraft is using its GPS to determine its position. The government is no longer going to be maintaining the continental radar system as you now know it. So what's going on with the IFF? Well, the IFF concept is actually still being used, but it's what's triggering the airborne components to send back the weather data that they're encountering. It's what they're seeing for altitude, as well as the lat long for the position, the speed, all these kinds of things, as well as being able to send digital information back up to the aircraft in the same way that we used to use ACARS, which is essentially DHF. This is essentially APRS for airplanes, if you will.
Okay, good information. Bill, please forgive me because I'm looking at the LIMOC roster under N1YDY. And unfortunately, the name there is listed as William, and I keep making that mistake. I should cross it out and put your name, Hank. Any idea how that error occurred? Back to you, Hank.
My middle name.
Now I understand. Okay. Makes a lot of sense. Okay. I think, Bob, W2OSR, you wanted to give us more information. If you're still there, Bob, T2LAW. Anyone else with any further questions or comments on the subject of ADS-B? Sounds like a great system. By the way, I'm going to pass it back to you, Eric. ADS-B, is it brand new, or has it been around for 5 years and I'm just in the dark ages and didn't know about it? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. The whole concept of next-gen was developed by NASA. It is a NASA project, and it was started over 15 years ago. I believe the actual implementation, we're now 5 years into it, and you'll find more and more of your major aircraft have ADS-B in them, although internationally they don't. They're required to, I don't remember what the date is, I think it's in two or three more years, it's required that every aircraft comes to the United States has it, and many other countries are in the process of implementing it now. So you got to figure within the next 5 or 10 years that ground-based radar is going to be a secondary device rather than a primary device. K2RIW, K2EJ. And if you want more information, NASA has an awful lot of it on their website.
Darn good information, Eric. Are we approaching the point where if I own a Cessna 150, I must have ADS-B on board in order to land at an American airport? Are we getting to that point?
K2EJ, K2RIW. K2RIW, K2EJ. At this point, we're only really dealing with commercial and military aviation. As far as civil aviation goes, I think the FAA is still kind of up in the air about it, but I suspect within the next 15 or 20 years, it's going to be mandated.
Okay, good stuff. Thank you. Any further comments before we go over to the space report? Give me a call, letters right now, K2RIW.
K2JIS, I think it will be mandatory by 2020.
I thank you, Roger. Okay, so that's coming down the pipe. We got to get ready. Paul, what's going on in space? Is NASA doing anything? I'm having some fun with him. WS2N, K2RIW, you got a poll. And I think this is space report number 166, if I've kept good records. You got a poll.
This is WS2N, and I didn't know NASA was responsible for that system. Very good. Good information by Eric. Quite a few little things going on, but nothing too major. We've got a couple of years before we start launching our own people from the United States. That should be real, that's going to be interesting. But now we have three members of the International Space Station that came back and landed on Friday, and that went well, down in the Soyuz spacecraft, and landed in Kazakhstan. When they came down, you can see the pictures from at least 20 minutes off. They had terrific it's coming down. And then right as it gets to the landing, they have landing rockets that go off in the last second to soften their blow. You know, they go on like 25 feet per second, and the rockets go off, and that brings them down to 5 feet per second. And they touch down, and you can see the big puff of smoke from the rockets, and you can see the bright flash. And then the wind came by, and it pulled it over. It's happened before, pulled the whole spacecraft over. So they didn't need that elaborate setup to get out of the Soyuz. They went in through the side, because, you know, they normally go in through the top. Now the top is on the side. So they went and got them that way. And apparently they were okay. It's quite jarring, they say. In fact, I remember years ago, first Hatfield came back on the, you know, the same system on the Soyuz. And he described it as like a car crash, you know. That's quite a blast when they hit. And they're insulated, their seats are insulated, each cushion is designed for each astronaut. And so, you know, you wind up, like the one guy winds up looking down on the other guys until they get out of there. So, you know, after sometimes a half a year, they're legless when they get off. They can carry them out. But that worked out okay. One guy was first Danish astronaut to go into space. They're flying with the European Space Agency. And he came out of Denmark. Andy Morgensen. He's a ham. KG5GCZ. Heard that announced on the radio, amateur news report. But they didn't say that he was going to transmit, but he did release two amateur satellites from the space station. He did get a chance to do that. These little CubeSats, they do that on a regular basis. They've done like 100 different CubeSats over the years. That's a popular system. So that went very good. Another thing I want to mention is SpaceX is they're thinking about using a Dragon to eventually go to Mars in the future. In 2020 anyway, there's another rover that's going to be going to Mars that NASA's going to be sending, similar to Curiosity. It's going to land there, and it's a lot of science work like Curiosity is doing. One thing it's going to be doing is a sample pickup system for a planned eventually return of these cylinders of Mars stuff. We'll drill into the surface and collect the long cylinders, put them on the spacecraft. Now they're thinking about using SpaceX to get it back. It was always planned that they would eventually, NASA would try to retrieve these samples. Now they're talking about having a Dragon-type spacecraft, you know, especially designed for this. They call it the Red Dragon. Elon Musk has been planning a Red Dragon for probably the last 5-6 years. And the idea is to use the Falcon 9 Heavy. You know, SpaceX launches the Falcon 9, and they plan on doing 3 at one time. You know, they're all bolted together. So this way they can get a tremendous lift capability. And they think about sending the Dragon to Mars using the Falcon 9 Heavy, which consists of 27 Merlin engines. Usually the Falcon 9 just has nine engines. They'll send that off to Mars and land near where the Rover 2020, that's what they're calling it for now, so we'll give it a name. The Rover will be able to drive over to Dragon. Rover has a robotic arm. Would be able to pick up those samples and put it inside Dragon. Dragon is also going to have a robotic arm, just rover. They could dig up their own samples, put that on board, and I'll picture a dragon sitting on Mars to get these samples back. They put it inside another rocket that's actually inside of the dragon that rocket would launch, you know, coming out of the center of the dragon. The dragon would stay behind, and the Mars return mission would take off and eventually head back to Earth that way. But I got some plans. It's not a confirmed mission yet, but it could very well go that way. So, definitely have to talk about that. I mean, that's going to be one of the many things SpaceX is good for. I mean, their ultimate goal is to go to Mars. I mean, that's their plan. Everything they do, Elon Musk is, in the back of his mind, is, you know, he wants to go to Mars. And all these rockets and money that he'll be making from all these flights, not only with NASA, but privately, turning around and taking that money and pouring it right back into the company. Future launches. Another thing I want to comment on, a lot of people know about Boeing and Lockheed. Well, when they come and work together, they have something called the United Launch Alliance. They launch all the Delta IIs, the Delta IVs. You know, they launch the Atlas V collectively. Not only do they, you know, make the satellites that go on top of them, they build these rockets. And is there now a bid by Aerojet Rocketdyne? It's a company that's been around for actually a couple of years with that name. They've had other names in the past, but it's the same company that built all the engines for the space shuttle. They're planning on spending about $2 billion to take over United Launch Alliance from Boeing and Lockheed. Not sure what that's going to mean. It's going to be better or not. It's just something I'll look out for. They build a lot of different rocket engines. Think of Aerojet Rocketdyne as originally going back many decades as being General Tire. So a company that started off selling tires, got involved with the rocket industry, no longer is involved with tires, but the big thing is rockets, also real estate, but the main thing is building rockets. They plan on building a rocket for the future Atlas V, which is going to be called the Vulcan. And we'll see. Not sure if this is going to be a good thing or a bad thing. But only time will tell. One other thing I want to mention is a company I mentioned before in the past that launches balloons. They're now called Worldview. It's a spin-off of Paragon. Paragon has been around for quite a few years. They've done a lot of, sent a lot of research up and equipment for NASA to the space station. And they've been developing a system to send people on a balloon trip, really. They've got this spaceship-like vehicle that they're building that will be able to handle 8 people and put on a balloon as big as a sports stadium and fly it into the stratosphere. Hanging from the bottom of the balloon is going to be this parasail, and it'll be in the open position in case the balloon ever failed. This parasail would be able to float all the way back to Earth. And in fact, that's what they'll do after spending a couple of hours at the highest point, like 130,000 feet up. People in this sealed spacecraft-like capsule will eventually disconnect from the balloon, and it'll fly all the way back down to Earth on this parasail. Their price for this kind of flight is going to be $70,000 right now. The reason I bring them up is World Worldview, which is the spin-off of this group, has now decided that they're also going to do commercial work. They've done it for NASA before and some other people. They send balloons up with lower payloads, you know, anything from a pound to 500 pounds. In fact, one of the people that is working with them is Alan Stern. Alan Stern, his